This episode of Revision Path is brought to you by Facebook Design. We talk about inspiration a lot here on Revision Path. So I wanted to ask Matthew Schoenholtz, a design manager for AR and emerging tech at Facebook, what inspires him?
I think seeing people use the products in ways that are meaningful in their life is very inspirational. I think the natural world inspires me personally. But as a designer, I think that it's understanding human behavior and then realizing that we can do something to improve the lives. That's inspirational to me.
Learn more at facebook.com/design. Are you looking for a job? Do you know someone who's looking for a job? Then check out our job board over at revisionpath.com/jobs. This week, Four Winds Interactive is looking for an art director in Denver, Colorado. We also have job listings from Indeed.com, so head to the Revision Path job board at revisionpath.com/jobs to apply and to search for any other listings. Don't forget to sign up for weekly job alerts so when there are new positions added to the job board, you'll get an email so you can be the first to apply. Again, that's revisionpath.com/jobs.
You're listening to the Revision Path Podcast, a weekly showcase of the world's Black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers. Through in-depth interviews, you'll learn about their work, their goals, and what inspires them as creative individuals. Here's your host, Maurice Cherry.
Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast. My name is Maurice Cherry, and before we get into this week's interview, let's talk about our sponsors, Glitch, Google Design, and MailChimp. Glitch is the friendly community where you'll build the web app of your dreams. Whether it's beautiful digital art, handy tools to help you do your work, or a site for your project or cause, you'll find things on Glitch that remind us the web can still be a fun, creative place full of unexpected surprises. Matter of fact, we just celebrated the 1 millionth project created on Glitch this week. So what will you create today? Get started at glitch.com. Google Design is a cooperative effort led by designers, writers, and developers at Google. They work across teams to publish original content, produce great events, and foster creative and educational partnerships that advance design and technology. For more information on news, design resources, and their design podcasts, check them out at design.google. MailChimp is the world's leading marketing platform for small businesses. Millions of people and businesses around the world trust MailChimp to publish the right content to the right person at the right place at the right time. Build your brand, sell more stuff, find your people, and tell the world your story. Sign up for a free account today and give it a try. MailChimp. Send better email. Now for this week's interview. We're talking to Mikkel Fine-Isles, Design Director at Bloomberg. Let's start the show. All right, so tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Mikkel Fine-Isles. I'm a creative director. I work at Bloomberg. It's a large company with roots in the financial space, but I work within the marketing organization of Bloomberg in what's referred to as the studio. And it's essentially its internal creative agency, and we work on a range of projects related to anything and everything under the Bloomberg umbrella. But my team specifically is focused on Bloomberg media products and properties and promoting them and creating brand identity systems and full ad campaigns. And so it's a quite a diverse range of projects and assignments that we're focused on. I have a graphic design background, and I'm kind of running a team of about five or so creatives of different backgrounds with, art direction, copywriting, animating, and editing capabilities.
What's a typical day like for you at Bloomberg?
It's fast and furious. It's literally kind of nonstop, wall to wall, lots of energy, lots of moving parts. It's actually quite a small team compared to the amount of work that we get. So despite the fact that I am a director, it's a kind of an all hands on deck sort of scenario every day. So I may come in, answer a few emails, go to a few meetings, but a good portion of my day is still spent actually laying things out on a computer or sketching or, you know, making things. And I really do value that. And I enjoy that. I'm glad I still have that, the time to do work and not just sit in meetings all day. So it's a combination of meetings, actually doing some work and providing, you know, direction and guidance to the team.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that about it being a small team. I feel like designers have really started to take notice of some of the kind of, I almost want to say, wacky sort of design things that have come out of Bloomberg within the past few years, specifically on the web, like through the website and everything. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it's also kind of communicated in the print edition of the magazine as well. How big is the team?
Well, it's you know, I think there are different organizations or different departments within Bloomberg. So there is a dedicated team that works on the magazine. They're not in my group. So the Bloomberg Business Week team sits within another department. I'm not sure exactly how big they are, but I get the sense they're about the same size as my team. So it's probably about five or so people, you know, dedicated resources with a few freelancers. And then the web team, again, is just kind of a different scenario as well. They have their own group. We do work with the web team and we do work with the Bloomberg Business Week folks, you know, overlapping on some projects or collaborating on some projects. But my team is more on the marketing and the advertising side. So we promote things like Business Week or, you know, .com or, you know, a bunch of events that we put together throughout the year, different products like, you know, podcasts or the TV channel and several other products. So there are little kind of groups and pockets of the organization that have their own creative teams.
Yeah, it sounds like, but it's all sort of all working together though under the same kind of design, I guess, aesthetic, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's been large chunk of what we do as a, you know, as a creative team within marketing is we do have the, I guess, advantage of kind of being exposed to all the different parts of Bloomberg. So within media, there are all these different teams and all these sort of people we need to collaborate with and you know, work closely with. And then there are folks in other parts of the company and, you know, financial products and the, you know, philanthropic side of things and the sort of internal company communications. All of it needs to connect and ladder up to the same, you know, brand philosophy and the brand values and the look and feel. And, you know, it all needs to sort of work together harmoniously. It doesn't always easily fit in one neat place. So that's a lot of the hard work that we do.
So I do have a question here. This is actually from one of our patrons and one of our writers. Her name is Sella Lewis, and she actually has a question kind of about the team and I guess about Bloomberg in general. Have there been any challenges encouraging design forward thinking within companies that don't quite have a reputation for being design oriented? I don't know if Bloomberg sort of falls within that description.
My standpoint, I came from different ad agencies, different, you know, design organizations, and you know, I worked at a digital marketing company for a little while. I didn't know much about Bloomberg prior to joining. I knew of Bloomberg, I knew the man, I knew that there was this massive company that existed, but beyond that, I wasn't very familiar with them. But the more I sort of did a little research, I do remember the magazine covers. That was sort of one thing that stayed fresh in my mind because they were so kind of outrageous. Just like they would put like two planes humping each other on the cover to represent, you know, an airplane merger. It had an edge that I love, had an attitude. And I think there's always been that in the company. And the more I learned about Bloomberg, the more it was revealed that there is this really strong sense of design and creativity and kind of risk-taking that shows up in different ways. It's a big corporate company. It's a massive place with thousands of employees around the world. And there's, you know, work with large financial institutions. So in that sense, there are some things that need to be kind of quieted down at times or err on the side of kind of more of a conservative look and feel. But I would say compared to the marketplace and competitors, Bloomberg is very edgy and has a very sort of distinct design point of view. And it can be fun. It can be colorful. It can be bold. It can have its own sort of unique look. And that's what sort of grabbed me when I joined the company. We've been able to push it here and there, you know, whenever it makes sense, we do some fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, like you said before, you kind of had done work before in the agency world. I know you worked in New York City, you worked at JWT for a while, you worked at Noise for a while, and now you're at Bloomberg. What's mm-hmm. the difference for you between design in the agency world and design at a place like that?
For me anyway, design at agencies previously has just been this like, oh, we need to put some design sauce on it. You know, we need to sprinkle some design on it. You know, like there's a team in the corner, literally in the corner. Those guys like live and breathe design. Let's get them to up the design on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a large part of my experience at other ad agencies, for better or worse. Great, talented people. But I never fully felt like design was ingrained in the company ethos or in the way projects were briefed in. When I got to Noise, which was a small startup digital marketing company that targeted young folks, that all flipped on its head because, I mean, there were like 12 of us, you know, in total in this company. I was the design director and I was literally sitting next to the CEO in his office / the only meeting room in the company. And we would just bounce ideas back and forth. And I would literally pull up, you know, Photoshop or whatever, Illustrator, and make stuff as I was sitting next to him and bounce some things back and forth. So that was a whole different ballgame. And coming to Bloomberg, we've had strong leadership that has design in their DNA. My creative director, Damian Topman, we actually worked together at JWT for a bit. He's a designer. He comes from a design background, and he's the global creative director at Bloomberg and in the marketing department. And he has helped, you know, along with several others, kind of built this design language and helped sort of establish the brand as one that's very design forward and has design in its DNA. So it definitely feels like we are part of the conversation, whether it's folks from Business Week or .com or elsewhere in the organization. Design is very much has a seat at the table.
Yeah, I would think, you know, with a company that, you know, takes risks, like you say, it's a kind of a financial / business publication, it sort of makes sense that they would also take risks in the area of design. So I get that.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, Mike Bloomberg himself is by nature a risk taker, you know.
Yeah.
And it's basically a huge startup. You know, it's his private company. It's something he started and was able to build into a, you know, super successful organization. But I think it still has that kind of startup scrappy quality, regardless of how big it is.
What's the design community like for you in New York City?
I mean, New York is one of a kind. You know, there's people from all over the world. Yeah, you know, some of the top talent from anywhere in any discipline, all here. There's always some sort of event going on. I recently, last month, went to something that AIGA put on about VR and AR and how that's kind of gaining some momentum as it relates to the world of design and creative industry. I think there's always something related to my career and there's always a workshop or a class or something that'll sort of help round out and expand my skill set. So I always want to remind myself of that whenever I'm feeling a little lethargic, or something as simple as just going to a museum, you know,
mm-hmm.
and there's just so much at our fingertips.
When it comes to like your general like design sensibilities, who are some of your influences?
I came from San Francisco, and I've always been influenced by murals and graffiti. You know, so some of the great graffiti artists of the 80s from movies like Wild Style. And so that kind of helped shape me, and even some just local graffiti artists, just seeing how they were able to, you know, quickly improvise and develop their own style and technique. And then I grew up in a neighborhood, the Mission, that was very predominantly Latino. And there's there still is this really rich cultural heritage of mural painting. So I've definitely been inspired by Diego Rivera and other great muralists. And then sort of moving more into like graphic design, Swiss designers, Joseph Mueller Brockman, and there's a Dutch designer, Wim Crowell, who I'm a huge fan of. And then, I mean, there's so many just, you know, contemporary folks that I look up to and always am eager to hear from, folks like James Victori, you know, and others that I think there are different folks that I look to and that I pull inspiration from. Mm-hmm. And then there are in the world of design, but then there are also fine artists or architects or musicians. And I think it's, you know, I want to make sure that I'm always looking beyond just graphic design as an influence.
I need to see Wild Style. I saw the Basquiat documentary recently, the one that just came out, Boom for Real. I don't know. Have you seen that?
I haven't. No.
There's a lot of footage in there from Wild Style. And so like they've got interviews with Lee Quiñones, and like it's basically about Basquiat leading up to his like big discovery into the art world. It's a good documentary. It's short. It's like about maybe an hour, not over an hour and 30 minutes. Like it's a short documentary, but it's packed with like I left the theater like really inspired because it just had so much footage and interviews and stuff. I was like, man, it really kind of lets you see what New York was like back then in like the late 70s, early 80s, and how that environment contributed to producing an artist like Basquiat. It was really good.
Yeah, the grit, right?
Yeah.
It was like broken, like abandoned buildings and run down sort of neighborhoods, but then there's some like beautiful art going on and some really sort of out there cultural movements happening.
Yeah. When did you decide to make the move to New York City?
2005. And it kind of happened pretty spontaneously. I went to school in Atlanta. I went to Clark Atlanta University, and then I graduated and I was ready to go back home to San Francisco and just kind of regroup and figure out where I wanted to go next, what was next for me. And I was working a little bit, I was freelancing a little bit in San Francisco, but I didn't feel like I was making much progress. Mm-hmm. And I had a childhood buddy of mine in New York, in Brooklyn, who I had stayed in touch with. And he hit me up one day and said, "Hey man, a roommate of mine is moving out. I have an open room here. Rent is like $400.
Shit.
And like, yeah, I was like, my ears went up like, oh, okay.
Yeah, what? Coming from San Francisco, I bet. Yeah.
And I can do that. I mean, I can do that at least for 3 months.
Yeah.
So I said, bet, let me get back to you. And I mean, it literally took just a few days for me to decide. I'd always loved New York. Both my parents are from New York. Mm-hmm. I had been visiting since I was a kid. And New York just has that magnetic energy. Even if you don't want to live here, it's just it's a special place. And if you're into hip hop or if you're into the arts, there's just something about it. So I always wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And so that kind of fell in my lap. And I had to do it. I didn't have a job or anything lined up. I was just like, I'm going to make it happen. If I don't, I'll just move back with mom and dad. You know, they'll take me back. So no, but knowing that wasn't really an option. I mean, it was, but I didn't want that to be the option. So I moved out, and it was like, I mean, it was in like February with massive blizzard the week, literally the week after I moved.
Wow. You know,
I'm talking about like 4 feet of snow. But I still, you know, I loved it. It was just like, this is it, man. This is me. I'm an adult. I'm on my own. I'm going to either sink or swim. And, you know, I literally was down to my last couple $100 when I landed a freelance gig at JWT. Big ad agency, which ultimately ended up into a full-time opportunity. And I was there for, you know, a little over 3 years.
Wow. That's quite a whirlwind.
Yeah. No question. I mean, I was, when it got rough, I was out there like, you know, passing out flyers.
Oh man. And, so you were hustling.
I was hustling, man. It was not smooth sailing at first, but you know, when you got rent, that's $400. You can make it work.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Just taking on little freelance jobs to keep food going, keep food coming and things like that.
Now, you might not have known this, but you and I were in the AUC at the exact same time.
Wow.
You were at CAU. You got there and you were there from like 99 to 03, right?
Yep. That's it.
I was at Morehouse at that same time.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
What was it like for you at CAU, like coming from San Francisco and being in the dirty?
It was a culture shock, no doubt about it. You know, I mean, I was ready for a culture shock. You know, I think San Francisco it's changed a lot since then, but it's always been very multicultural and very open-minded and very liberal. But it's a small city. It's a very small city. There's not a large Black community. And now there's like 10 Black people left in the city. It's crazy. But even back then, I just felt like I wanted to live in a Black city. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be near family. I have family in South Carolina, which is about like 3-hour drive from Atlanta.
Yeah.
And I went on a college tour and Atlanta just hooked me, man. It was like, I was like, I have to do this.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I wanted to study at that point. I mean, most people don't when you're a freshman or even a sophomore, even later. I mean, there's so much going on. There's so much flying at you.
Yeah.
You got interested in women and just trying to enjoy yourself and I wasn't really focused on a career at that point, but Atlanta was just had a great energy. And Clark specifically I know they're different schools, but I was literally taking classes at Spelman.
Yeah.
Walking by Morehouse every day.
Yeah.
We had parties together. We had friends who went to different schools over there. So it was definitely a community and it felt like I was a part of something. And I was able to make some really good friends early on. And that really helped to just kind of survive all the other stuff that's being thrown at you. Yeah. And I had made some good friends who were actually from the Bay Area and that helped kind of just keep that like home sense of home nearby, mm-hmm. you know? So.
Yeah. I don't know if people realize like that freshman year, I mean, specifically the freshman year that we were there, like 99 going into 2000, there was a certain energy in Atlanta that, I still live here, but there was a certain energy there. And I don't know if it was because I was just new to the city, but mm-hmm. that has been hard to recreate. It was like post-Olympics, mm-hmm. like post-Freaknik, right at the turn of the century. There was just this certain like electricity about Atlanta. And like you said, the schools are, they're interconnected by the Strip. So like you go out on the Strip, it's folks from Clark, folks from Spelman. Like I took classes at Spelman during the summer leading up to me going to Morehouse. And I think I took like 2 or 3 classes at Clark, like bio or something like that. So even though the schools are pretty distinct and separate, I mean, Morehouse is all men, Spelman's all women, Clark is co-ed. You could take classes at each other's, you know, schools and then just kind of like interact. It was just like one big community, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also like, as we're talking about it, I just remember, you know, it's probably the same for you. Everyone in my circle just had a hustle mentality.
Yeah.
Like everyone was like, regardless of how young we were and how, you know, green we were, it was still felt like people were ready to make moves, you know, in their respective like career paths or whatever. And I just we really fed off each other. People wanted to, of course, enjoy their time there, but also like get this thing going, right? Yeah. Like build connections, get internships, meet people, learn what they could and soak in as much as they could. And I think that was really healthy. And now that the more we're talking about it, it's important to remember that.
Yeah. I think it helped that like, it was also like in the city, you know, like sometimes you'll go to college campuses and they may be in smaller towns or they may be kind of segregated off from the main community. Like we were like in the thick of the city. Like you could hop on the 13 and you're right in the middle of downtown Atlanta and mm-hmm. you know, go anywhere you want to.
Yep. I know. And at one point, it was a buddy of mine, and we had our own barber shop kind of run out of the dorm rooms. We had it on lock. Like, you know, we all both kind of had our own style, but we basically went in together and we promoted each other. And then we kind of carried that through to when we moved off campus. And it just felt like we had this like sort of entrepreneurial kind of vibe, and we were connected to the city, and it was like, you know, we were building connections through that. No, it was an awesome time.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you can't recreate that feeling of like being out on the Strip that late, getting wings at Stiegel's, chilling. Oh man, don't get me started.
Forgot about Stiegel's. Busy Bee.
You were in the design program at Clark. I didn't even know that Clark had a design program at that time. I had no idea that existed. What was it like?
It was great. And I want to back up a little because I think for me, I'll always remember my time at Clark. And I think there was this pivotal moment when I was a freshman. And I'm young, I'm a freshman, I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing. I knew I was interested in making visuals somehow, some way, right? I had always been drawing and been interested in making images. And I knew that Clark had a strong media department. You know, Spike Lee went there. Other very prominent, well-known folks in media have passed through Clark. And I went to the media department. And at this point, you know, I'm really interested in like being Hype Williams, you know, the director who made Belly and other, you know, music videos. I was like, yo, I could be this dude, man. I can make some music videos. I got ideas. And I can't remember his name for the life of me, but I think he was one of the directors of the media department. I sat down with him. We had a good 20-minute conversation. He just let me talk, right? And he was just listening and just hearing me out, let me, you know, ramble on about what I wanted to do, why I wanted to be a music video director. At the end, he says, you know, listen, Mikel, you're welcome to stay in this department. We'd love to have you. But from what I'm hearing, it sounds like you need to go up to the art department and talk to them and just see what they're about. You might be interested in working out of the art department. So I did that. I was like, all right, I mean, we'll see. Mm-hmm. I was a little skeptical. I didn't know what the art department, I was kind of like you. I didn't know they had an art department. And if they did, I mean, what was it, like two people? Like, what's happening? And so the art department was up on the hill past Morehouse and Spelman up towards the freeway.
Oh, yeah, it was in that church.
Little church. Yeah, it was in the church.
Yeah, Park Street, yeah.
Park Street Church. I was like, what is this random church? How is that the art department? Why is it, you know, so I'm skeptical at this point.
Yeah.
I go in there and I just fell in love, man. I mean, people were making things. They were working on posters. They were making lithograph prints. They were carving things. They were using computers. At this point, like, I wasn't proficient in any Adobe Creative Suite program whatsoever. I'd opened Photoshop once or twice. And I was like fascinated. I was mind blown and I stuck. So there was an art department, fine artists. There was a very small design group. Literally like three of us graduated, but we had some really great teachers, underrated teachers. And there's a lot that happened beyond that point.
Wow. I got to look into that. I mean, certainly as like, I'm trying to do an upcoming HBCU month. We try to do it like every year. Sometimes we're successful. Sometimes we're not, but I hadn't even looked at seeing like what it's like at Clark. I know Morehouse sort of had an art department, but not really. Mm-hmm. We had like an art teacher, but I mean, I think we mostly knew that Spelman had like a really good art program. They had the museum on campus, but I didn't know that Clark had a design program like that. That's dope.
It was. And we actually did have quite a few classes at Spelman. I guess mm-hmm. they, you know, we just kind of overlapped and I'm glad they did, because some of my favorite classes were at Spelman with, sculpture class or a life drawing class with Larry Walker, who's Kara Walker's dad. I think Dan may have talked about him.
Oh, wow.
He was incredible, you know, just kind of learning forms and lighting and shading and all the details. And, you know, I think his class, you know, really stands out to me. It's just kind of a different way of kind of looking at everyday figures and reinterpreting them and finding your own voice. So, yeah, Spelman was great, and I'm just, yeah, it was a really strong artistic community at the AUC.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if it wasn't just like formal art programs and stuff, it felt like people were always doing something artistic, music, rapping, et cetera. That's where I first heard about Janelle Monae, actually, was like on the strip one day.
Right.
And she was performing. You remember there used to be this little bookstore. It was like in this pink building, like a small, like, it was almost like a house or something, but it was like a little shop, and they would sell like books and like incense and stuff. And they had a little like patio, like a little wooden patio off to the side. And she was performing out there one day, and she was selling CDs, like just burned CDs of her first CD, The Audition. That's how I first heard about
her. That's crazy. That's crazy. That's great. You remember that. Cause I just recently read that Janelle Monae was going to, did she go to Clark?
I don't know where she went, Spelman. Actually.
She was down there anyway. She was down there like the same time we were. And I was like, man, I wish I had like paid attention more.
And some people from her crew We went to Morehouse together. I know specifically George 2.0, who's in her, is like, I think he's like one of her, I don't want to say hype men. I'm probably getting the title wrong, but him and I were like in the same class, ran together in the same circles like a lot. Mm-hmm. So man, that was a crazy time back then. Wow.
Lots of talented folks coming through there. I mean, it's great. That was a special experience.
So I have a question for you. So we both are designers. We both went to HBCUs. What do you think about what HBCUs are doing now, if anything, to like prepare the next generation of designers?
I mean, I actually don't know. I wish I had a better connection to what HBCUs are doing now, but I do know that there are some great, talented young folks coming up. They're more expressive, that are more sort of, that have tapped into their voice and have fewer like filters, right? You don't fit into a box.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's important. I think there's like this sort of combination of understanding digital and social and, you know, also knowing how to tell a story, how to communicate a message. I think those are all important like qualities of creativity that don't necessarily need to be confined to one title, right? You don't necessarily have to be a graphic designer anymore. You can be a creator, you know, you can be a creative technologist or an illustrator or get into sort of, you know, VR and AR or other things. And I think there's so many possibilities that hopefully HBCUs are tapping into what's happening next, right? And arming folks with code and different skill sets so that it's even more kind of diverse than when we were coming up. Because I remember when we were coming up, it was like, all right, here's Photoshop. Here's not even InDesign. Here's Quark Express.
Or PageMaker or something.
PageMaker, right. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, learning some of the fine art classes and skills, you know. But now there's so many other tools that young people have at their fingertips that I never took a class on how to design for social or how to tell a story through even video. You know, I know that was a possibility, but like now folks are just like so much more equipped and it's great.
And also, like, you know, those educational programs just weren't even available back then when we were studying. I mean, I remember I got to Morehouse and I had been experimenting with the web and stuff in high school. Like, just like I would go to my mom's job. She worked at a college and like play around with learning HTML in the computer lab. And so when I got to Morehouse, I started in the dual degree program. I was computer science, computer engineering. And I kind of just thought they were all related. Like I wanted to be like Dwayne Wayne off A Different World. And so I go into the computer science department at Morehouse and I tell my advisor that I want to make websites. And he just kind of looked at me like I had an arm growing out of my forehead. Like, he's like, what? He's like, the web? He's like, the web is a fad. Like, nobody's going to be doing things on the web in 5 years. He's like, that's a toy. He said, if that's what you want to do, you need to change your major. And so I changed my major. I switched to math, which I like math. I was good at math in high school and stuff. And so I switched to that. But I had always thought about, I mean, I've been thinking about it, you know, just on and off throughout the years. Like, if there were a design program or some sort back then, like what it would have been like, you know, I mean, at Morehouse, they just didn't have it. And now there's so much stuff on the web. You can be self-taught. There's boot camps. There's places like General Assembly, et cetera, where I feel like now if you're starting out as a designer, there's so many choices that you have. Like we just didn't have that like 20 years ago. It's wild to think how much it has changed in just such a short amount of time.
It's true. It's crazy. You know, but I will say, I think there's a benefit that we have coming up when we did. Like it's kind of in between, kind of like an in-between moment.
Yeah.
With right before mobile, you know, right before the iPhone, right before, you know, Facebook and all that. And a little bit after, you know, the sort of big kind of like print revolution, right? And so design was definitely respected at that point and had a firm sort of root in society. So we learned the importance of communicating clearly, telling a message and the sort of principles of design or color use and composition and all of those, typography, all those kind of foundational components, but we also were able to experience mobile technology coming to play and designing for the web and building things for small screens and, you know, being able to kind of see both parts of it.
Yeah.
And be able to kind of tweak how we approach things, but still having that foundation of like, all right, regardless of what you're making things for, whether it's a huge billboard or like a tiny, you know, screen, you need to be able to communicate a clear message. You need to be able to represent the brand, whatever the brand is, or yeah, whatever the thing is you're promoting. So that's something I always try to keep in mind. I think it's a benefit. I think it's an advantage that we have, actually, that we're able to able to have that foundation, but also be able to adapt.
I agree with that. And then also really to be able to kind of self-propel ourselves in terms of learning this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much that we had to reverse engineer and figure out that it wasn't just laid out right in front of us in the form of a tutorial or a class or something.
It's true. It was so new, or it was so kind of, you know, maybe that's part of the HBCU thing. It was like it's kind of a hustle mentality.
Yeah.
Right. You're not going to have the most resources. You're not going to necessarily have the most high profile teachers or the biggest budgets or even like the best quote unquote talent nearby. But maybe it's kind of untapped talent. Right. And you have to kind of make your way and mm-hmm. figure it out and connect the dots on your own and do your own research and, you know, meet the right people, get internships and learn on the fly. Right. And learn as you go kind of thing.
Yeah. It was a lot of hustling. I know even junior year, I was hustling to try to find internships and I was doing work study in the computer science department and had to sneak my name in the interview book so I could interview at Microsoft and Real Player and at these places. Cause even coming up in the math department, you know, their idea of post-college work was just going to grad school and doing more math stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's not really what I want to do. I had still been doing stuff for the web. I did the web page for our scholarship program. I was taking clients, you know, on the side. And I was like, yeah, I think this web thing is what I want to do. So, you know, you have to be crafty because there was really no way to find out. Like, because back then it was like you were a webmaster, a web designer, or a graphic designer. Like, that was it.
Right.
And so if you didn't fall into one of those three, you know, kind of tracks, you were stuck. And yeah, now there's so many different titles and it's just so many different ways now to be a designer. It's amazing, really.
It is. Totally.
So what keeps you motivated and inspired with the work that you do?
I think just learning. I want to keep growing. I want to keep evolving. There's so much out there to try that I haven't tried yet. There's so many, you know, I get ideas occasionally just on my own, not related to any brand or any client, but just, hey, it'd be cool to do this thing, right? It'd be cool to make this poster. It'd be cool to make this little like video game or whatever it is. And just working with great people, you know, there's, I think that's always what I've been driven by throughout my career is the collaboration part of it. I feel like I can work on my own and I can have fun, but it's always going to be for me more fun to go through, you know, the lifespan of a project with other people, bounce ideas off each other and, you know, kind of share the kind of aches and pains and the joy at the end or even in the middle, right? Where there's like, this is something cool. We can build it. We can do it. And it's going to come to life and people are going to put their own kind of, you know, spin on it.
Yeah.
You even
spent some time studying overseas, right? You were in Denmark for a while.
I was. Yeah, I was. I mean, I was very fortunate to have that. My wife, who was, I don't think we were married yet at the time. She was in grad school. She's also a designer. She's an industrial designer. She was in a program at Pratt, which is a industrial design, has an industrial design program. And they had a study abroad portion where she chose to study from Copenhagen and to live there for the summer. And I said, let me see if I could latch onto that, you know, and just kind of... just kind of piggyback my way over there somehow. Luckily, at the time, I was working at a startup. I had a good relationship with my boss. And, you know, I just kind of asked him outright, like, look, man, what do you think? Would it be all right if I worked from abroad over there? Yeah, I was expecting, like, you can go for a couple of weeks, but, you know, we kind of need you back.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, man, go for it. That's a great opportunity. Do it.
Nice.
And I don't expect that to ever happen again. That was a rare gift, but they were cool. So I went over and we found a house to live out of, and she was going to school and I was, you know, working remotely on some projects for my job. And then I actually found some time to take a class, to take a 3-week workshop in interaction design. Mm-hmm. And that was eye-opening. Those 3 weeks were some of the most electric and kind of dynamic of my, you know, entire career, I'd say, where, you know, I was open to things like Arduinos and programming. I don't know if you know about Arduinos, but
yeah.
And it's working in this program called Processing, taking data and bringing it to life algorithmically and thinking through physical interaction design, but also digital interaction and, you know, different displays. We built a robot, you know, albeit a crude robot out of a stuffed animal, but we made it move, you know, we controlled its movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, in those 3 weeks, there was so much creativity and so many ideas flowing and so many talented people from around the world who gravitated towards this place. It's called Copenhagen Institute for Interaction Design, I believe.
Nice.
So, yeah, no, I think that just opened my eyes to a whole nother kind of world out there beyond just typography and color and form and, you know, composition. And, you know, going back to what inspires me, I think it's things like that, man, learning about how technology comes into play.
When you look back at your career and your experiences, what advice would you give to your younger self? Like, if you knew then what you know now, what would you say?
Travel more.
Yeah.
Work abroad more. I don't know why I never did. I mean, I travel a little bit with family, but I never went and studied abroad when I was in school. And there's so much out there culturally, you know. I'm fascinated by like cultural sort of traditions and artistic kind of backgrounds of all these places from, you know, these far corners of the world. And the U.S. is a really small kind of young culture in the grand scheme of things,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah. And so if you have an opportunity to go really anywhere, right? I mean, Japan, Mexico, Africa, Europe, Latin America, anywhere, I would encourage young folks to do it. And I wish I did more of it.
Yeah. Is there anything that scares you creatively?
Creatively, no. I think what scares is maybe not the best way to put it, but I think what's always been like a hurdle or a challenge for me is the politics or it's the egos or the all the other stuff outside of creativity that gets in the way.
Yeah.
And I think that's always going to be a thing, you know, when you're especially working in a large organization or in a corporate company or an ad agency, there are egos, there are other people you need to work with and you need to figure out how to work with them. And so it's figuring out how to build the right relationships. So it doesn't scare me, but it's just something that, you know, requires a different part of your brain.
Yeah.
You know, if it was just about creativity, I think it'd be one thing, but it's especially as a director, you know, as you kind of rise through the ranks, so to speak, more and more, it's about relationships or strategy and working with people and getting them to kind of agree to your approach. The design part is to me, is a little bit of the easier part.
So in terms of you kind of leveling up from being a designer to getting to that director level of design, you say that relationships are kind of the thing that has made that possible?
Yeah, big time. I mean, I'd say basically every job I've gotten is, for the most part, through a contact that I met somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
whether it's like a previous job that I had or back to an internship that I had when I was in school. It's relationships. I mean, you hear that over and over, but for me anyway, it was so true. It's like, you know, I started out as a graphic designer, kind of became an art director. And then, you know, folks I've worked with just either liked my work or, you know, liked working with me or both and saw potential and were willing to kind of take a chance on me stepping up. And, you know, I've been able to show them that I could, and that just kind of builds more relationships, right? You know, if you're a hard worker, right? Going back to that hustle mentality, a lot of it is, I feel like creativity is just a part of it, to be honest. I mean, I think a lot of it is really work ethic, being smart, being able to work with people, being able to sort of think strategically, connect the dots, being able to listen to your coworkers and the people you know you work with and your clients, and being able to communicate. Those are, to me, just as important as the actual putting the pen to paper part of it.
That's very true, especially, I think, the communication part, being able to really sort of accurately articulate your concepts or your thoughts or things like that. I tell that to designers a lot, especially ones that write to the show.
Right.
And want to know how they can like get to that next level.
Yeah.
And I tell them they need to, you know, be doing more communicating, more writing, or anything that just gets your thoughts out there in a way so people know that you're more than just like a set of hands that can like make shit in Photoshop, you know?
Exactly. Especially now, I mean, with all these programs, all these tools, there's so many image makers out there.
Yeah, yeah.
That can make a picture. Anyone can make something look good. But what are you trying to say? What do you want people to feel? And that's not always easy to pull off. You know, you might, it's hard to get something out of your head sometimes. And I think you, that's a real art form in its own right.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned your wife, you've mentioned your family just kind of briefly. What are the best things that you owe your parents?
Well, my parents are, neither of them came from a traditional art background or design background. My dad's been a cab driver for like 30 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
My mom is a teacher. She just retired. Congratulations, mama. They've had creative spirit, you know, creative energy throughout my upbringing and much earlier than that. You know, my dad played music on and off and is a big sort of music enthusiast. My mom is a craftswoman, right? She makes jewelry. She gardens. She makes kind of like these like bohemian like pottery objects, I guess. Uh-huh. I don't really know what to call them, but there's definitely a creative spirit running through my home when I grew up. And whether it's like these big sort of posters that we had on the wall, or musically, or just kind of visually, we were engulfed and surrounded by so much from different cultures. And that was something that helped kind of put me on this path. That and just encouragement, you know, I understand that not a lot of people, especially Black creatives, don't always have the sort of support to pursue their design interests. You know, kind of like your story, how you were kind of told, no, don't get into web design. You need to study math.
Yeah.
I know that story gets told a lot. And I was fortunate enough to not really have that. They saw that I loved to draw. They saw that I was into making visuals, and they were very encouraging.
Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? What kind of work would you like to be doing?
Oh, man, I don't know. I have been giving this some thought, and I wish I had a better plan. I think ultimately, though, it's more of kind of what I talked about when I was in Denmark. You know, it's like pushing the boundaries of what my definition of design is, you know, and I think it's learning things about code, interaction design, UX design, working in the VR and AR space, and just getting out of the traditional, let's make a print ad, let's make a 30-second TV spot, because I know I can do that, and that's fun, but I want to continue to stay challenged. So I would say in 5 years, it's pushing myself out of some of the mediums that I'm used to. I also think it's continuing to travel more, maybe potentially trying to, you know, work abroad for a little bit. And I always like kind of flirt with the idea of starting my own thing. I don't know if that's a 5-year thing, but at some point down the line, having my own studio or my own kind of organization, like small shop where we're able to experiment.
Yeah. I mean, I think for every designer, it kind of helps to just have your own thing that's separate from being beholden by clients or by your job or something, something where you can just really kind of pour yourself into.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, a big theme for me is control, and not that I'm a control freak, but, you know, and I do love collaborating, but I think feeling like I, like my voice is being heard and like I am, building something. And that's always what I've looked for. And that's what I've each of my jobs, I've had different versions of that. And at Bloomberg, I have that. I'm lucky to have a seat at the table, so to speak. And, you know, my voice is respected. But I just want to make sure that I'm continuing to take control over the trajectory of where things are going in my career. What sort of messages do I want to put out in the world? What sort of ideas do I want to share with people? So that's just something I'm conscious of.
Well, just to kind of wrap things up here, where can our audience find out more about you and about your work online?
So you can find me at mikellfineisles.com. It's MikellFineiles.com. That's my website. It has a snapshot of my projects. And also check me out on LinkedIn. Those are probably the two best spots for getting a sense of my work.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Mikell Fineisles, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I really like a lot of what you said about just kind of your story of getting from a place of trying to figure out what your next step was going to be to now really making it as a designer in New York City, as a design director, I should say. I like kind of how you spelled out those differences between agency life and sort of corporate life, I guess, with Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. It can kind of be a bit of a tricky thing, I think, for designers to realize how their skills can play across sort of different disciplines like that. And also just good to meet another designer that went, you know, to the AUC, especially like right around the time I was there, that can appreciate the culture.
Yeah.
What that was like.
And Stiegel's.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you again so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Maurice. Thanks for having me. It's great. I love what you're doing, and keep it up, man. Thoughts of love are in
your mind. And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Mikell Fineisles, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about Mikell and his work through the links in the show notes at revisionpath.com. Also, thanks as always to our sponsors, Facebook Design, Glitch, Google Design, and MailChimp. With a community of over 2 billion people, the design team at Facebook works on a diverse range of problems. Everything Facebook designs is done at scale, so research, content strategy, data, and lots of other factors are a huge part of how they work. Sound interesting? Then learn more about Facebook design and what they do at facebook.com/design. Glitch is the friendly community where you'll build the web app of your dreams. Now, if you've seen Glitch, you might think it looks like a toy, but let me tell you, it's not. It runs on the exact same infrastructure and engine that the best developers in the world use to run their apps. And it's all built around a friendly community of coders, designers, developers, artists, activists, and educators. People just like you. Get started on making something awesome today at glitch.com. Google Design is a cooperative effort led by designers, writers, and developers at Google. They work across teams to publish original content, produce great events, and foster creative and educational partnerships that advance design and technology. For more information on news, design resources, and their design podcasts, check them out at design.google. MailChimp is the world's largest marketing automation platform. They support millions of customers from small e-commerce shops to big online retailers, and they support the creative community as well. MailChimp really gives you the marketing tools to be yourself on a bigger stage. Visit MailChimp.com and sign up for a free account today. MailChimp. Send better email. This episode was edited by RJ Basilio and produced by me, Maurice Cherry. Our intro voiceover is by Music Mandre, with intro and outro music by Yellow Speaker. If you liked this episode, then please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It only takes a minute or two. It helps more people learn about the show, not just here in the U.S., but internationally as well. It even helps the show by bumping us up in the rankings in general for design podcasts. And I'll even read your review right here on the show. Revision Path is brought to you by Lunch, a multidisciplinary creative studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, if you're listening to this and you want to hear next week's episode early, then you should become our patron over at Patreon. Now more than ever, Revision Path needs your support to make sure that stories about Black designers and creatives in our field are being told in their own words. So if you support us, if you support our mission, if you support our journalism, then just go to patreon.com/revisionpath and pledge today. For just $5 a month, you can get access to behind-the-scenes information about the show, upcoming interviews and articles, and so much more. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.